Welcome to the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast. With your host, Joe Manko. Yahoo Sports. This is the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast. Right now.
Hello, soccer fans. This is the FC Yahoo Podcast, and I'm Joe Lago, editor of the FC Yahoo blog. With me for this latest episode is Leander Scharlaken, Shahan Ahmed, Joey Galino, and Alex Baker. Yes, we have a full house. And according to our followers on Twitter, you want us to talk about the U.S. men's national team. In fact, over 40% of you voted for a USMNT discussion. We will also be talking about the Premier League match day 23 and all what and everything that happened the last couple of days this week. So, guys, let's talk about USMNT. The U.S. began Bruce Arena 2.0, the second stint of Bruce Arena as U.S. men's national team coach. It didn't go very well in a 0-0 draw. I mean, provided you really can't expect a whole lot from guys who've been training for, 3 weeks with tired legs against a Serbia side. They didn't have any European players either, but included some decent talent, especially I think they had 5 players from the under-20 team from the U-20 World Cup. But I'm going to throw it to Leander first. You know, what were the big positives or big takeaways from the 0-0 draw in San Diego, Leander?
As you kind of alluded to, it's hard to take away a whole lot from that because it's January camp, it's off-season. The opposition was I think we most fairly can describe it as a C team from Serbia, as it was only players from the domestic league, which and one player from the Cypriot league, let's not forget, and the Serbian league is not very good. So, you know, it's one of those games that's really just a glorified scrimmage that kind of happens to be on TV. That said, there were a few players there that I thought really stood out, and I wrote about this, and you could kind of lump them together as the sort of creative midfielders that the U.S. had. And that was Darlington Nagbe, I thought was good. Sasha Kljestan was solid, especially, you know, given that he hasn't had many reps yet this season. I thought Sebastian Legette on his debut was very nice, and Benny Failhaber in his long-anticipated return to the scene had some nice touches. He had some turnovers too, but I thought that was encouraging. And something that Bruce Arena has talked about a lot since taking over is the need for a real playmaker in the U.S. team, which is something that Jurgen Klinsmann had just kind of given up on. You know, he'd occasionally move someone like Jermaine Jones or Michael Bradley high up in the midfield. But they're, with all the goodwill in the world, strong players as they may be, they're not playmakers. So for him to throw out all four of those guys in the same game, I thought was very encouraging, and I thought they did a nice job. I think they can fill that role. I think you need some defensive cover for them. But if we can read anything into that game, as I wrote on the blog, it's that, you know, those four guys might really help make a difference.
So, yeah, no, it was good to see the creative players freed under Bruce Arena. Legette was, you know, with the few touches that he had, actually made things happen. He even set up a couple of chances. Alex, you were there in San Diego to watch the friendly. First of all, how was it getting down to San Diego from LA, and what did you think of Qualcomm?
Qualcomm is, I was saying before that we were talking, it was a weird atmosphere. Qualcomm's a big stadium. I'm thinking 50, 60,000 capacity. It looks like something that you would have seen on the Wide World of Sports in about 1978.
It's your classic cookie cutter stadium.
Yeah, and it's kind of crumbling, and the NFL team has left. So it had this kind of haunted, empty feeling. There are 20,000 people there, which is a pretty good turnout for a January friendly, but it looked so empty. So I felt like the atmosphere was not really conducive, and it just kind of added to the kind of eerie, flat quality of the whole kind of experience of being there, including the performance of the teams. You know, afterwards, I read comments from Bruce, and, you know, he had a positive spin on it, and I was like, yeah, okay, I can see what he's saying. You know, it was defensively fairly solid. We limited Serbia to 2 chances on goal. But we didn't create very much. And this was not a great Serbia team, as Landry was saying. It's a team that had six caps total, that team we played. So I would like to have seen some more creation from the USA. That said, yeah, Darlington Nagbe put in a great shift. Leggett came on, really lit things up, I thought. I thought that the Zusi at right back experiment actually was not a failure, maybe not a resounding success, but I think there's potential there. And I also thought Jordan Morris came on late and provided a spark. So if I want to put my hopeful USA hat on, I say, okay, we didn't lose, we didn't blow it, we built some defensive things, we got some new players vetted. Those are all positives.
What did you guys think of Michael Bradley and Jermaine Jones, that partnership back together? Bruce isn't going to make too many changes, yet Jermaine Jones is not going to be available for that Honduras qualifier in March. Who do you guys think should start alongside, provided that Bruce has the two holding mids? You know, even if a 4-4-2, he's going to go with Jermaine and Michael Bradley. I mean, Joey, who do you think should start alongside Michael Bradley when they play Honduras at Avaya Stadium in San Jose?
Well, I think that's an interesting question, and I think Sebastian Leggett obviously put in a good shift as kind of like a havoc-wreaking midfielder who could play alongside Bradley. But I also think it ties into, if you think about what Jurgen Klinsmann did with the team and how he kind of played players. You know, we've been talking on the podcast for a long time about how he played players out of position. I think one of the things that kind of contributed to the way the match played out, in addition to what Alex was saying about, you know, it's first time back for everybody, the atmosphere was kind of so-so. You know, Michael Bradley was great in kind of the deeper lying midfield position, but he hasn't played that so much recently that it's almost like playing where you're the most comfortable or playing where you have excelled in the past is a new experience for some of these guys. So I think that, you know, like you said, with Jermaine Jones out for that next qualifier, you know, you look at a guy like Leggett who can step in and play alongside Michael Bradley. You know, the Zusi experiment wasn't an outright failure. And, Josie Altidore's back up top with, you know, no strike partner, which is a debate unto itself, whether he should have one or not. But I think that there's kind of an element of refamiliarizing these players, some of them refamiliarizing themselves with positions where they're best, where they didn't play in that position that much under Jurgen Klinsmann. So I think that that was a key element of this, too. I think that even though it was a scoreless draw, you know, for the team going forward, kind of reacquainting themselves with those spots and those positions on the field is going to be a good thing. So to answer, I didn't answer your question really. I said, well, Leggett, you know, is the guy.
You're still bringing up some really good points.
Yeah, I think that Sebastian Leggett can step in there. I know Galaxy supporters will love to hear that, like our friend Alex here. But no, it really is the best answer, I think, just as kind of a stopgap for, you know, the games or the game that Jermaine Jones is going to miss. But I also think there's an element of what I talked about, how you can, you know, these guys, once they refamiliarize themselves with these positions, that'll be good for the USMNT going forward.
So both Jones and Kleschen have returned to their clubs for MLS preseason. Leander, and this obviously is another opportunity for, you know, Friday's friendly against Jamaica. Is this an opening for Leggett? Not for a starting role, but to really secure a place in the squad as we go on to get into the teeth of World Cup qualifying?
I think so, because if you kind of look at the roster and assess how it's evolved, even going back under Klinsmann, I think, you know, even though I have a lot of misgivings about him as manager and I think he made mistakes, there are sort of sound lessons that we can learn. And one of them is that Alejandro Bedoya is not a holding midfielder. And so since he seems pretty set on having Michael Bradley as his six, I think that rules out Dax McCarty playing alongside him, mm-hmm. because that would kind of, because he's more of a holding type of guy. And that would mean Michael Bradley kind of moves back into the eight role where he's going box to box, which it just doesn't seem like that's what Arena wants to use him for. So, you know, Darlington Nagbe, I don't think has the engine to be an eight. Benny Failhaber doesn't have the defensive coverage. So then you arrive back at Leggett. So I wouldn't be surprised at all to see him get a shot to really make that role his, or at least to climb a little bit in the depth chart. Not forgetting, after all, that Jermaine Jones is 35, that he'll be 36 in November, and therefore, you know, it's hard to say what kind of shape he's going to be in for the 2018 World Cup, provided that the U.S. gets there. I mean, Arena has said he's not worried about the way he'll age, and he certainly looks like he's got a few more years in him. But at that age, you just don't know. I mean, you're really one big knee injury away from being done.
You know, on the other side of the back line was Greg Garzer at left back. And it seems that Arena is still looking for that answer. You know, who was going to be his left back? DeMarcus Beasley is still with the team in Chattanooga. How do you guys think that's going to shake out? Could Greg Garza really be that guy at left back?
I mean, not on the evidence, I don't think, about what we saw in San Diego. I think he was pretty poor by most accounts. You know, and if the other option is an unattached DeMarcus Beasley who has no club, I don't really know.
I mean, Fabian Johnson can do the job, but I think Fabian Johnson's best position is you get him higher up the field, because I think that's the issues that we see against teams, yeah, more talented teams, is the U.S. is very stagnant. It really sits back and really can't go at other teams. So, you know, Fabian Johnson, his best position is up the field on left wing.
Definitely, yeah. But that said, he's done a great job at left back for the U.S., particularly in the World Cup, where Klinsmann said he was possibly the best left back in the tournament. So that is an option. And I don't think that Garza has earned a spot ahead of Johnson at this point. So, you know, based on the current pool of players, I was a little disappointed that Robbie Rogers didn't make the cut, because I think he's been a good left back at the Galaxy. And I thought that his familiarity with Arena might have helped him shoe into that position. But
there's only so much nepotism that's allowed from the Galaxy. Yeah, and Brian Rowe was in camp.
It's true.
Let's talk about the goalkeeper situation. I was reading Steve Goff's piece today with Bruce Arena, and he said that he's going to have a three-man core at goalkeeper. Brad Guzan's one. Nick Raimondo at 37 is going to be included. That raised a few eyebrows. But who, you know, what do you guys think of Raimondo's performance on against Serbia? And who is going to be that third goalkeeper, because Tim Howard's still recovering from groin surgery?
Yeah, that's really the question, is who's going to kind of take that third spot. Like, when you – Raimondo on over the weekend against Serbia was – you know, Taylor Twellman kind of alluded to this on the broadcast, that he wasn't really tested a whole bunch, but when he was, he was ready.
Safe.
And that's like that's one of the most difficult things to do, is to kind of sit back there. And, you know, as a goalkeeper, you're always into the game. You're always making sure people are in the right positions. But at the same time, you know, you're not having to use your cat-like reflexes very much. But he did come up and make the saves when he needed to. And you just wonder if that is going to be the norm with him, because he's a guy who's been on Gold Cup rosters. You know, I think he was on the 2014 World Cup roster, but he's never been like a feature guy for the U.S. So it's kind of, you know, and Guzan has shown himself. He's had very, very good games, but he's not an unimpeachable number one like Tim Howard was for a long time, for example, or maybe a Casey Keller. You know, the U.S. actually has a pretty decent history of goalkeepers. And that's not necessarily Guzan's place. So it's important to look at the backup roles. And Raimondo, as great as he played, is a little kind of like, you know, I'm not sure if he can be that guy going forward. And then the third spot is just all kinds of up in the air.
I realize he won't be available for Friday, obviously. But going forward, I'm kind of looking at Ethan Horvath as potentially a guy who's going to get in the contention. No, he just made a move from Mold to Club Bruges in the Belgian league, which is, you know, not a top league, but Club Bruges is one of the better teams, I guess, in the Belgian league. So I think he's definitely a guy to keep an eye on. I would think that you know, when it gets time for the actual qualifiers to start again, that Horvath might be in the frame.
I have high hopes for Horvath as well. I mean, he's only 21, and to have as much experience as he's had at that age, and he's played a fair bit of Europa League, if I'm not mistaken, with Molde. I'm not sure that they pronounce it Mold, but you know the Belgian
sounds
league
better
as
Mold.
We'll make it Mold. Yeah,
it's funnier right that way.
He was a moldy goalkeeper. You know, the Belgian league certainly isn't a very good league, but with Club Bruges, he does have a chance to play Champions League regularly, or to play you know, Europa League group stage again, and possibly even the knockout stages. So I think that's a nice move for him, because at that age to be playing regularly is such a gift. And I think that's something that we saw in Bill Hamid, who has to be the other option, I think, in this equation, because he's 26 now and he's basically been a regular for DC United since he was like 20 or 21. And it really shows because he's quite polished for his age. I would expect him to be the other guy really in contention there, because I'm kind of surprised that Raimondo is still featuring so prominently when you consider that when the a few days after the 2018 World Cup kicks off, he's going to be 39. And even for a goalkeeper, that's quite advanced. I like Luis Robles. I think he's a good goalkeeper. I don't think he's going to set a World Cup on fire or anything, but he's steady and he's solid. He's 32, so he's got a few more good years in front of him. So it's somewhere in that mix they're going to find someone. But I agree that Guzin is not automatic. And when he comes back from Middlesbrough to Atlanta United to return to MLS, I think that distinction that he held for a long time, that he was a Premier League regular, that falls away. And he's sort of on more even footing with the other guys.
Yeah, I think Raimondo's selection, you can look at it a couple different ways. I know Bill Hamid had a knee injury, right? I think that's what knocked him out of the U.S. camp for this month. But I think him starting in this game, it kind of says, you know, you can look at it either like, okay, Bruce Arena didn't really have any other choice because, you know, he was the clear and present number one just to fill in for, you know, these friendlies. Is it that, or is it he actually thinks, like you were saying, Leander, you know, Raimondo's going to be, he's pretty old even by goalkeeper standards. So does Bruce Arena actually think he's going to get, you know, the consistent play that he needs out of Raimondo going forward? Is he actually, like, in the pool for number one? Because you've got guys like Ethan Horvath and Hamid, and I think David Bingham's another name that's come up, the Earthquakes keeper. And, you know, in this transition period, just because it's the U.S. is scrapping to reach a World Cup, I think you've seen in the past with not just the U.S. but other countries, like, sometimes the best time to test somebody, to have someone become part of the program going forward, is in these situations where they're immediately thrust into these crisis spots. And I think that you can learn a lot about a guy like Ethan Horvath or a Bingham or a Hamid when you put them into this situation and see how they react, because the stakes are high. You know, we all know, we've talked about it, like, the U.S. basically can't afford to lose any more games. You know, they're still very much alive for getting to the World Cup, but it has an urgent process. There's very much a sense of urgency there. And so this is a good time to test some of these guys. And the selection of Raimondo, that's kind of what I got from it. Like I said, I thought he played pretty well. But at the same time, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, did Arena do this because he's comfortable with him and because he was right there to be able to play? Or does he actually not believe, relatively speaking, enough in the development of the guys behind him yet to put them in that spot? And I think that could be a potentially troubling thing for the U.S.
I think him sticking with Raimondo speaks to the way Arena has said he was going to do things. He said, you know, there's no time to build. There's no time to reinvent the wheel. I need to just find the guys that can do the job right now and go with them. And, you know, philosophically, you can say the third goalkeeper spot, you can use it on a young guy to get him a little bit of experience or exposure, or you can use it on another guy who might help you win games. And Raimondo, even for his advanced age, I mean, I can't remember him doing very many things with the national team or Real Salt Lake that made you question him being there. And he's a guy that U.S. head coaches have historically loved because he's such a good team guy. You know, he went to the World Cup as the number three guy, knowing that he had no chance of playing. And he was fine with that. And he came to practice every day and he had a good attitude and he was well liked within the locker room. So he's a really safe bet.
You know, what troubles me is how the U.S. goalkeeper situation, which historically has been a strength, has become a question mark. I'm not going to call it a weakness, but it is very much a question mark. And even if a healthy Tim Howard comes back, he won't be, you know, in full match fitness. He probably won't have a whole lot of games under his belt. So, you know, even though his history says that he can do the job, you know, you're not getting the, you know, top form of Tim Howard. And I think, you know, I'm not going to put this on Klinsmann, but, you know, not making the Olympics, not qualifying for the Olympics, I think has had a factor in setting back the, and not being able to develop someone as an heir apparent. I think Guzan has always been the one who was going to take over for Tim Howard, but then his club form dipped. So now we're in the situation where we don't even know who is really who should be the number one. This is all by default. You know, Tim Howard, if he's healthy, he'll get it. If he's not healthy, it'll be Brad Guzan. And we've seen Brad Guzan is, you know, he's struggling. Ethan Horvath, didn't he play against, he was in that Cuba friendly. I mean, he looked like an inexperienced goalkeeper. Over time, this might be the answer. But right now, you know, it's a problem right now.
Yeah, it is. And Alex, I'll kick it to you here in a second. But yeah, like I you always kind of have, look at the history of the U.S. national team since, you know, it became what it is today and qualified for the 1990 World Cup. You had Casey Keller and also Brad Friedel. You know, you had Tim Howard and also Casey Keller. You've always kind of had like a couple of guys who you'd feel really comfortable with. And with Howard, you know, still like out of the picture for the moment. Guzan hasn't really stepped into that role. Like, he's good, and we all agree he's a solid keeper, but there's not really the definitive answer there in the back like there always has been. And instead of having, you know, multiple guys who could do that, the U.S. has gotten to a point where you're not sure any of the guys could do that.
Yeah, it's funny. I was just thinking back to the World Cup. I remember writing a little cider story about it. It was the first time the Netherlands had started a team without a van on the team sheet in like 15 years or something. I forget what matches. But we're entering a season where it'd be the first time we don't have a really good, bald American keeper playing in the Premier League. And we seem to have had this endless stream of them for about the last 15, 20 years. And we don't have one. And that was usually whoever that guy was your guy.
I'm going to take that as a compliment, as a bald-headed American.
I'll be there with
you. It could
be
an opening, Joe. It could be an opening is what I'm saying.
Was that bringing up the Dutch? Was that a setup for Leander Lander?
Yeah, that could have been. That could have been. Yeah,
I really have no idea where Alex was going with this. So I'm just gonna let that hang.
I hear Alex's German isn't very good. Your Dutch isn't like very German, good. It sounds like Leander. German. Yeah.
Yeah.
But so, how did this come about? When were you talking? When were you speaking Dutch to Leander?
I said sorry to Leander last week in Dutch.
Oh, okay.
So it sounded German.
Also, it was one word.
I couldn't tell that it was Dutch.
Oh well, you did say it was Dutch. It sounded like German.
Yeah. It's trying to make you feel better, man.
Thanks.
There's another injury on the USMNT that could be a problem going into World Cup qualifying. It's Jeff Cameron. You know, he hasn't played in a few months. I think it's 3 months now with a knee injury at Stoke City. He was here in LA to get checked out by the USMNT doctors. And it's not looking like he's going to be available for that March 24th Honduras qualifier. So who is going to start alongside John Brooks? If we all are in agreement that Bruce Arena is going to stick with what he has, and John Brooks does start in central defense, who starts alongside him? Leander?
If you put me on the spot right now, I wouldn't be surprised to see someone like Steve Birnbaum maybe get a shot at it. I mean, what you're losing in Jeff Cameron is basically someone who's strong in the air, someone who's a good one-on-one defender, and someone who's good on the ball. And there's no replacing that directly, I don't think. Cameron is pretty unique in his skill set in that sense. I mean, Brooks has gotten a lot better at those things as well. But, you know, short of maybe Omar Gonzalez, who I'm not so sure would... is in the picture right now. You know, the options are actually pretty limited. When you look at the number of defenders that have been called up to the U.S. in the last year, it's a staggering number. It's like 20 or 25 of them. But if you look at who would you trust right now to step into that role, that's a much shorter list. So I wouldn't be surprised if it were someone like Birnbaum.
Yeah, I think isn't Beisler still recovering from an ankle surgery? Birnbaum seems like the readiest answer. You know, Matt Miazga, we all had high hopes, but Chelsea loaned him, to the Netherlands, I think. So he isn't really quite there yet. There's not really an easy answer. I mean, it's kind of funny. Every weekend I get on my phone to the Yahoo Sports app. You all should download it. And I look at the lineup for Stoke City, and I'm like, Cameron's still not in it, you know, because you know how soccer injuries are. They're not always like the clubs are not and the players are not always forthcoming with the details. A person could return by surprise or they could be out for longer than they say. So I'm always kind of hoping to see him in there because he really is, you know, like Leander was saying, he's good in the air. He's got great awareness. I actually think his reflexes are underrated. I think he's quicker than people give him credit for. Maybe not in the open field, but when he has to react to a play. So, you know, he's a guy that the U.S., if the U.S. wants to maximize its potential, he needs to be in there. But he's not, so I think Steve Birnbaum is, you know, I agree with Leander, is kind of the readiest answer because none of the other guys have really stepped up and made a case for themselves, you know. And like I said, I know Beisler's injured, but it doesn't change the fact that the U.S. is kind of, like we were talking about with the goalies, they're sort of in a position where people aren't really taking advantage of these opportunities.
Alex, do you think, I'm going to throw this to you as being one of the two resident Galaxy fans on this podcast. Do you think Omar Gonzalez gets a look from Bruce Arena? And I'm just going to leave it at that.
Yeah, I think possibly. You know, Bruce sort of presided over Omar's golden period in his career when he played himself into the national team. And as we're saying, there's just not a lot of great candidates. Birnbaum, I think, had an indistinguished performance of the day. He wasn't bad. He wasn't great. He didn't mess up, I guess you could say. There's another guy who's on the team right now, Walker Zimmerman, who hasn't earned his cap yet. He hasn't, but if he, I'm curious if he might get a shot tomorrow, maybe as a substitute at least. I'd like to see what he might contribute. But, you know, I still believe in Omar Gonzalez. I think he has the potential to be a USMNT player.
I think the thing that everyone points to, as much as they point to Jossie Zardes' poor first touch, is the moment where Omar is just going to ball watch or just get completely lost that leads to a chance or even worse, a goal.
It's an annual rite of passage. For that.
Let's move on to the final friendly of January camp as January camp closes, the Chattanooga friendly against Jamaica. Leander, what do you or who do you think will break out? Who needs to make his mark in Chattanooga?
I think this is a big opportunity for Benny Failhaber, and not to harp on him so much, but you know, with Kleschen not there, and with you know, Jermaine Jones, who isn't really a direct competitor, but it doesn't hurt that he's not there because it might shift some guys about possibly. This is a real chance for him, I think, even though it is preseason and even though that might not necessarily be fair on him, you know, to really step into that number 10 role and show why people have been harping on his name for so long and why people have been, you know, so keen on his return for all those years of the Klinsmann freeze out. So that's one name that I'd really be looking for.
Yeah, I think Failhaber, another thing to think about with him is when Klinsmann was the coach, you know, I'm not saying that Failhaber was disruptive or anything to the national program, but he always, you know, there's no question, he always made sure to make his opinion known and his voice known on what Klinsmann was doing. And, you know, he knew that the tweets he sent out, for example, would always be, you know, consumed by U.S. fans. So it's kind of like, okay, well, we all kind of agreed with you. Here's your shot to make the most of yourself. And I would also, you know, I'd throw Sebastian Legette's name in there. You know, he's a guy who can really kind of lock down a spot if he plays well in the midfield again. And, you know, Nagby, I think Darlington Nagby is someone we've all wanted to see consistency out of. So let's, you know, he has a good game against Serbia. Let's see him do it again against Jamaica. And again, I understand it's a January camp and it's not the end of the world if he doesn't, but it would be nice to see something like that.
I'm looking forward to, well, I'd like to see Juan Agudelo
Swagadelo
make his mark in this last friendly. You know, he came on against Serbia, did some things.
Yeah.
He, you know, I feel like this guy's been on in the USMNT pool for decades, but yeah, I think there's still something there. I think he, you know, with he's revitalized or revived his career with the Revs. The second guy I'm looking, or you know, maybe might break out is Jorge Villafana,
mm-hmm.
who's going to get a look at left back. He's currently playing in Liga MX for Santos Laguna. But, you know, maybe he might be the answer at left back. All right. Well, we should take a break. And after the break, we'll get into topic number two that our followers voted for on our Twitter poll, which is the Premier League title race, or otherwise known as how the top six are flailing about, floundering. We'll be right back after this.
The break.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to this week's break. I'm Joey Galino. This weekend is the annual championship of American football, the Super Bowl. And as much as I love soccer, I also love the Super Bowl. It's a one-off, do-or-die scenario, which adds extra weight to the proceedings. The Champions League final is the same way. And while there's something to be said for the militaristic 38-game campaign through which every level of the English football pyramid goes, the sudden consequences of a loss is something soccer doesn't feature enough, if you ask me. Sure, if you suffer a setback, there are debates about a team's place in the title race or the relegation battle, or the relative state of a club. But there are still tons of chances to rescue points or fix whatever's wrong or ascend in the league table by whatever means. In my view, the immediacy of a loss is sumptuous. It's something that I like about American football, and it's something that I like about the FA Cup. The fourth round was this past weekend, and there were some exciting results like Sutton United ousting Leeds and Millwall dispatching Premier League side Watford. Now, pretty much the only people speaking up for the FA Cup these days are the old-timers who played when it was still a seminal competition, before Sir Alex Ferguson devalued it by withdrawing Manchester United from the 1999-2000 competition, and the bigger clubs began trotting out sides full of end-of-benchers and training academy players under the illusion of trying to advance. But the specter of an instant finish has always made the FA Cup exciting to me. And in order to bring urgency and excitement back to it, allow me to trumpet the increasingly popular suggestion that the winner should qualify for the Champions League. This would give extra impetus to a club this year like, say, Manchester United, which is an odds-on favorite to not make European football's grandest tournament given its place in the league standings. It's hardly just the Red Devils, too. The top four race is so up in the air that Tottenham, Arsenal, and Manchester City would all benefit from fielding beefed-up sides in an attempt to earn a spot the league table might not grant them. This is how you restore the shine to the FA Cup, how you raise it from an EFL Cup-level competition to a third major English competition that's actually worth caring about. A non-stop parade of Game 7s works for the NFL, it works for the Champions League final, and it works for the FA Cup, provided, of course, there's something to play for.
We are back. This is the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast. I'm Joe Lago, editor of the FC Yahoo blog, and we're going to be talking about this really odd Premier League title race where it seems like, you know, other than Chelsea, no one really wants to make a run. We're going to talk about Match Day 23, which was another odd turn of events, which saw Liverpool tie Chelsea 1-1 to salvage, well, for the Reds anyway, to keep any their flickering hopes alive of making a run at Chelsea. We saw Man United draw 0-0 with Hull City, thanks to some really remarkable saves by the Hull goalkeeper, Jakubovic. And we also saw Man City thrashed West Ham behind, well, we've already anointed Gabriel Jesus as the savior for City. Alex Baker has. But we will begin this discussion of Match Day 23 with Arsenal, which was at home against Watford, gave up two goals in the first 13 minutes, and tried to fight back, but ended up losing 2-1. I'm going to throw this to our resident Arsenal supporters. What do you make of the Gunners, who seem to have fallen into this, well, typical form that we've expected them over the years?
Well, yeah, it is typical. It's you always expect, at this point, it's kind of become like clockwork. Arsenal is going to lose a match or two that they absolutely shouldn't, that could help advance their place in either the league table or, you know, whatever. And this was that match. Like, Chelsea is at Liverpool. Regardless of what happens in that match, you have to approach it if you're an Arsenal player, if you're an Arsenal coach, if you're an Arsenal whatever, and say, okay, there's a good chance that Chelsea drops points here. Not that they outright lose, because they've been very good about battling and getting at least a point for most of the season, if not outright winning, but you have to say, like, okay, they got a tough fixture. We've got a home fixture against Watford. Watford has its share of challenges it could present, but this is not a team that you should lose to. And sure enough, you know, you get an unlucky bounce on the first free kick, and then you fall behind 2-0 after, what, a half hour or something like that? And you know, the Aaron Ramsey experiment ended after, what, 20 minutes, and he was completely ineffective. But it's just, it's always something with Arsenal losing these games. And I think it kind of speaks to a bigger thing that's going to happen to Arsenal here, because the next match, as we all know, not to get too far ahead of ourselves, is at Chelsea. And then after a couple of matches, I think Arsenal's home to Hull, but then after that, you know, they've got FA Cup and Bayern Munich in the Champions League. Then the next match, Premier League after that, is at Liverpool. So the biggest loser by far here is Arsenal, because now you had a chance to cut the lead for Chelsea atop the table to 6 points. Instead, you don't even get a point from the Watford match at home. It kind of reminds me of the Swansea match a couple years ago at home when there was still a chance to contend for a league title and things like that. So now you're talking about, now you're tied with Tottenham in second in the table, and I think Arsenal's third on goal differential, but you've also got City right behind you at 46 points, and Arsenal's got some tough fixtures coming up. So not only could Arsenal drop out of the league title race, it might start to be a scrap just to get back in the Champions League with some of the fixtures that are coming up.
It's funny. I feel like we have this, we could take this conversation from a year ago and splice it into this podcast, and it, you know, just change the name.
No one would know the difference.
Just change the names of the teams that they've dropped points to. But it's the same conversation, and I think I said it even last week that I don't think anything is going to change for Arsenal as long as Arsene Wenger is the manager. I think it's always going to be this way, that we're going to lose these silly games that we shouldn't lose. We're going to squeak into fourth place, maybe third place. I know we finished second last year. We're going to get knocked out of the Champions League, and we're going to be, you know, hoping for another FA Cup win. And it's disappointing, and it's, you know, it makes you want to bang your head against the wall as an Arsenal fan. You know, and you have to pose yourself the question, if you look at the last 3 years in the Premier League, with a different manager, would Arsenal have won a title? I think they quite possibly could have. So it's disappointing. It's an inexplicable loss, the loss to Watford. But at the same time, it's completely predictable that this would happen.
Yeah, just real quick. It's inexplicable, but it's also kind of, it is explicable because of the way that Arsenal's been for the past few years. So while under normative circumstances you're like, they shouldn't lose a game like this, we've seen this happen so much that you're kind of like, oh, there's the Arsenal stumble.
Yeah, but what makes this year different, in my opinion, is that I genuinely don't know if they're going to finish top four.
I agree.
And that's the thing, is that in the past, you know, even when they had these stumbles, you're like, oh, another year, top four, out in the Champions League, round of 16, same old, and then you're like, well, they'll finish top four. This year, I don't know about that. I mean, the way their inconsistency combined with, you kind of see this little like boiling pot with Alexis Sanchez. He's getting more and more frustrated by the pass. You know, he's just, it seems like he's almost had it, and you feel like that's going to somehow not really help in the locker room either as the season progresses, as they become that team that's clearly not in a title race at all, as they're not playing in Europe. I think it's going to be something that kind of puts them in a weird spot. And then I think Liverpool's gone through a tough stretch, but I expect them to rebound a little bit at the very least. And then United, yes, you know, Joe's convinced that this was their high point and they're going to like kind of sink again. And whether or not they do, I still think that they're going to be in that top four race to some extent. So, I mean, Arsenal, I just don't think there's any guarantee or close to it that they're going to finish top four this year. And that would be a stunning change from the narrative that has always been the predictable Arsenal narrative of underachievement and really just not impressing anybody.
I think I agree. I think, well, you know, I think United is always going to be on the periphery. I predicted before the season they wouldn't quite make it back into the Champions League. I think it'll still be that way. I agree with you. I think Liverpool is kind of in a dead spell right now, but they're going to be better going forward. I think that the league race this year actually is kind of simple to explain. It's two guys with the same sounding last name, not the same last name, Conte and Conte for Chelsea. N'Golo Conte has got the endless engine in the midfield. He's been absolutely fantastic winning balls and making plays, and he's been kind of the catalyst behind the on-field resurgence, I think. And not that everyone else doesn't, you know, deserve credit, but I think that's a big part of it. And I also think Antonio Conte has brought a great spirit to the club. He's brought everybody back together, and I think that's fantastic. And I also think, and again, this kind of sounds a little mundane, but if you look at the league table, Chelsea has as many losses. I think, you know, Tottenham's got less losses than Chelsea. Liverpool has as many losses with three. So does Manchester United. The difference is Chelsea is winning all 3 points when they can. Chelsea's got 18 wins this year. The next closest, Arsenal and Manchester City, have 14. So, you know, I know this always kind of makes a difference in the league table and winning a Premier League title, but they're not dropping points. Chelsea is winning the games that other teams are drawing. I think this past weekend was only Chelsea's like second draw all season. And again, as mundane as that sounds, that's huge because those points are making the difference at this point.
Damn it, Joey. We said we would not talk about Chelsea this week. We were over their title race. Yes, they're leading by 9 points.
What was the over-under? How many minutes?
Yeah, I'm sick of seeing Joe smiling over there. This is getting out of control.
I like Joe, so I would like to see him smile more.
Look, you know, Chelsea they got out of Anfield with a point, which is, you know, was what I was all Chelsea fans were hoping for. But if you're objective, you would say Liverpool was the better side. And, you know, with those Firmino missed chances, you know,
such awful. The first one was worse than the second. He had to generate power.
The first one was terrible.
The first one, he had an open goal. It could have taken a touch. He had all day to put that in.
He literally just had to touch it.
Yeah.
No, what the point I was going to bring up was, you know, Chelsea was lucky to escape Anfield with a point. But on the flip side, Liverpool has been just as wasteful with its opportunities. They're still in the race, I guess. You know, 10 points back, but it really doesn't feel like that. You know, Anfield, you could sense just through the TV that all the tension, like, we need to win. We need to win this. It was a must-win game for Jurgen Klopp.
For the league.
Yeah, for the league. And Leandro brought it up, you know, in his recap of the game. It's still, though, thankfully, this is still a title race. But, you know, does it really feel like it when all these teams are wasting all these opportunities?
It won't be a title race after Chelsea beats Arsenal this weekend.
No, absolutely. It's a question of Chelsea is not playing perfect soccer. They're not kind of running away and hiding with the league like we've seen on occasion. Like Manchester United did that a couple times during Sir Alex's reign. But they're not doing that. But the thing is, like, how can you sensibly expect one of these teams behind them to kind of rise up and take those points? Because as you mentioned, Joe, Liverpool's not scoring goals right now. And if this Jurgen Klopp side in particular is not scoring goals, well, they're sure as hell not going to defend them, even when they're very good. So they're kind of out of it. Pep's kind of finding his way at City. United's still in a little bit of a mess. Arsenal is doing God knows what. I think, personally, I had Tottenham finishing second in the league table before the season started. But even they have kind of offered you glimpses of, you know, you're not sure about where they're at. With all their talent and kind of coming together and trying to replicate what they did last year. So it's not so much a question. Chelsea, you know, looks great atop the league table, but if you want to talk about having the race become a race again, it's like no one has demonstrated that they're going to try to take those points from Chelsea, and Chelsea's just sitting up there like, nobody? Okay, you know, that's fine with us.
When Joe originally posed this question to us, the question was, you know, who is the biggest loser in the top six? Because we didn't want to go into this Chelsea conversation. And
sorry.
Initially, I was sitting there going, probably Tottenham, because, you know, if they just scored one goal, if they just collected those 3 points, even though it was a draw against Liverpool and Liverpool, like, were the better side in many ways, you felt like Tottenham are the really, really the only challengers. But then you take a step back and say, there's only one team that lost out of that top six this week, and that was Arsenal. Arsenal's always going to be the biggest loser this week, this match day. And you know what? If it would be complete Arsenal to beat Chelsea this weekend and then lose to Hull.
I think that's going to happen. I already told another friend. I said, watch Arsenal come right back and just run rampant over Chelsea. And then you all think of Arsenal's back.
No, and then they'll lose to Hull. That's what's going to happen. That is the most Arsenal thing to do is to follow up a massive victory against a top team and then lose to a team that they have no business losing to.
Are we all in agreement that if Arsenal lose to Chelsea, then the title race is pretty much over?
It's been pretty much over.
It's been pretty much over. And let me lob this out there, too. If Chelsea beats Arsenal this weekend, again, I'm kind of a sucker for schedules and kind of looking ahead and predicting results. The next few fixtures for Chelsea, Burnley away, away, maybe tough, Turf Moor, whatever, but it's still Burnley. No offense, Burnley fans. Then home to Swansea. Then at West Ham, home to Watford, at Stoke, which can be kind of tough, then home to Crystal Palace. Chelsea could end this thing, like literally mathematically end this thing by like April 1st if the rest of the teams at the table aren't careful.
Let's bring Leander in here. Leander, do you think this title race will be over if Chelsea beats Arsenal on Saturday?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, because if you look at the gap at that point, and if you look at the form of everybody else, I mean, those other teams all have issues, and then there's Spurs, who are, even if they seem fairly issue-free, aside from a whole bunch of injuries to key defenders, they're still Spurs, and they can be relied upon to Spurs this thing up. And it feels in a lot of ways, guys, and I'll put this to you as well, it kind of feels like Leicester last year. I think it was Shahan who said, Chelsea's kind of going like, all right, if nobody else would do it, why don't we take the points and why don't we go to first place? And that's, if you'll remember, how Leicester wound up being champions last year, where everybody just kind of self-destructed in one way or another and just kind of said, all right, you can be champion, that's fine. That's how it feels with Chelsea this year. And the other thing that I'm really wondering about is this is the final year on Arsene Wenger's contract at Arsenal. If they finish out of the Champions League spots, do you guys think there's any chance that he's the Arsenal manager next year?
I'm going to respond to both things you said because I think they're good points. First of all, I've actually thought myself, too, that this Chelsea run real quick kind of resembled a bit of what Leicester did last year. N'Golo Kanté is obviously a constant in that regard. And as you said, they're kind of atop the table. And if they're like, well, if nobody else wants to take the points and win the league, we'll do it. But I also look at, Diego Costa is kind of having a resurgent year. And I'm not saying Jamie Vardy never had, obviously, a great year in the Premier League before last year. But he was a guy who kind of finally lived up to his potential. So you can say that Costa's living back up to his potential. You have a wing guy, Riyad Mahrez, who explodes onto the scene last year for Leicester. This year, Eden Hazard's kind of had a comeback of sorts for Chelsea. So I do think that there are good parallels to be drawn there. And as far as the Wenger point is concerned, I remember the very first podcast we ever did, we talked about I don't think this was an outright topic, but it came up. What would it take for Arsene Wenger to leave Arsenal, to either be forced out or leave on his own accord? And I think, Leander, you and I agreed that it was missing the Champions League. It wasn't going to be something that he would do himself. I think when Stan Kroenke realized he can't just sit back and print money for making the Champions League every year despite fielding a quote-unquote contender that we all know really doesn't really have a realistic shot to win the league, it would take something like that. And if he is out after this year, I think that sometimes these things happen suddenly more than they happen gradually. And I know people have been calling for his head a lot, but I think if you ask a lot of people right now, they would say, oh no, even if they miss the Champions League or whatever, it's still hard to see him leaving. But I think that could change when it actually happens and people actually have to go through that and experience it in a couple months. I think that could be the catalyst. And I'll actually go ahead and say yes. I think if Arsenal misses out on the Champions League this year, they will not renew Wenger's contract. They'll bring in someone like Eddie Howe or maybe someone, from the periphery, from the outside we're not thinking of. And it'll be a new direction for the club after a couple decades.
Yeah, I agree. I think that if Arsenal fails to qualify for the Champions League, then Wenger will go. And whether that's he's let go and they don't renew him, or he does the honorable thing like the officer who locks himself in the room with the pistol, I just think that.
Wow.
But that's coming from an Arsenal fan, and I adore Mr. Wenger. But there seems to be some genuine talk about the club looking at Max Allegri. We're hearing that name tied to it. So I think. I think he wanted to go out with a title this season, and I think they had a great opportunity to do that, and I think they've blown it. Maybe this week, maybe they blew it in December when they lost us two games back-to-back, but they're not going to win the title, and I think this might be the year for Wenger to go.
We talked about this last week a little bit, and I'll just rehash the fact that the Premier League gives so much money just to be in the Premier League. I don't think that it's nearly as much of a blow to Stan Kroenke if they don't make the Champions League next year. And Arsenal is still going to be a premier, if not the premier London club. So in terms of attracting talent, that city will attract talent and that club will attract talent. It might not be able to keep the talent like we're seeing, and that's kind of the problem. That's been the problem with them in the past. But is that going to be the catalyst for him to leave because management says, you know, there's not enough financial like reasoning to keep him around? I don't think the financial aspect is going to play a part at all. He might just leave on his own accord because it's time and he sees the writing on the wall that they're not trending upward anymore.
So let's go with these hypotheticals of Arsene Wenger actually stepping down or being ousted as Arsenal manager. What does that look like? Do they continue to play this way? Or you bring in a coach who's going to change, you know, the way Arsenal has been known to play for how many decades, you know, for two decades now? I mean, are you guys willing to, you know, for the sake of getting, for having change, to risk maybe that style that has defined Arsenal, that does, it's still the prettiest football that's played in England, I think we can all agree. But I'm putting it to you two guys, the Arsenal fans. You know, what are you? How are you envisioning this post Wenger era that could happen?
Well, you know, I don't want to troll Leander here, but you know, that's a Dutch football debate. They're always debating that. And if you look at the last two World Cups, I don't think either of those teams played very Dutch football. Not under Van Marwijk, and not necessarily under Louis van Gaal, and they finished second and third in the World Cup. And I remember in the 2010 World Cup in particular, they were getting a lot of criticism, and Ruud Gullit was a TV pundit, and he said, you know, we played the same way for a long time. We didn't win much. And I think Arsenal are getting to the point where they've played Wenger ball for 20 years but haven't won much for a long time. So to me, I would love to see a manager like Diego Simeone come in who completely different style but gets more out of his team than someone like Wenger, who I don't think is getting as much out of these players as they have to give. So, you know, I wouldn't necessarily mind the new direction for Arsenal.
Yeah, I think, like I mentioned, Eddie Howe's name has been brought up. You, brought up Max Allegri. You know, Arsenal has been so defined under Arsene Wenger as kind of this attacking side that plays beautiful football that will, you know, maybe pass up the easy goal for the pretty goal, so to speak, whether fair or not. That's kind of the reputation. But I also think back, you know, because so many of us, like, because Wenger's been there for so long, it's easy to forget that, you know, the George Graham sides of the 1980s and even before that were kind of built on a steely back four, and kind of it was a more gritty side. Now, when you look at Wenger's best teams, the Invincibles immediately come to mind. Yes, they played that beautiful attacking style, but they also had the spine of the Vieiras and the Sol Campbells that was really hard and fast down the middle. So it becomes a question. You know, Eddie Howe's name has been thrown out because people talk about him playing the same kind of spirited attacking component style that Wenger does with lesser parts. And, you know, you give him that transfer budget, you give him those resources at Arsenal and see what he could do. Allegri's come up because he's obviously had great success with Juve, and it's kind of like, well, you know, are you bored winning Serie A every year? And, you know, do you want a new challenge? And, you know, is it like he gets a chance to maybe take Arsenal places in the Champions League that they haven't been for over a decade? I think that what it would look like is a decision that Arsenal is going to have to make, because just because you move away from the Wenger style doesn't mean that it won't be successful, because Arsenal, for a long part of its history, wasn't really that. And English football, I think in general, wasn't really that for a long time.
Yeah, there's going to be a change in the style. I think that's, you know, whenever Mr. Wenger leaves, you have to look to make a change, I think. And I think Allegri would be a good guy to bring in, only because of the fact that he has played several different styles from the way he set up at Milan to Juve. And also because I guess there's some controversy in terms of Paulo Dybala didn't really want to shake his hand over the weekend. It just kind of created a weird situation where...
Wait a minute. Are we talking about Serie A on our podcast?
Yes. I was going to say, no one...
Is Shahan talking?
There should be some horn, some alert.
There's no... No one gets bored of winning Serie A titles, all right? Let's get that over with, over and done with.
Do they not? I don't know. I mean, Conte seemed like he did.
In any case, we're getting a little bit off track here. What I'm trying to say is that, you know, I think Simeone would be a better fit. I don't think Eddie Howe is the right personality because I think in order to come into Arsenal and especially replace Arsene Wenger, you should have really a trophy cabinet full. You should have something to show for yourself where people come in and automatically really respect the fact that someone's going to come in and make it a new club in a new direction and a new style. And as much as Eddie Howe, I think, is a good manager and he's an up-and-coming guy who is definitely proving his worth as the years go on, I think that you want to bring in somebody who's more proven. And I think they're going to turn into more of a Chelsea type of club when it comes to managers. Maybe not that type of, not looking for that type of turnover, but I think they're looking for that type of gravitational personality.
Yeah, but this Wenger era is, well, the last 10 years really, has been also more of a business model because, you know, they don't spend a whole lot. You know, they've made attempts to sign guys like Juan Mata and Luis Suarez and ad nauseum. But, you know, Wenger makes, well, he makes the most of what he has in order to finish top four and guarantee that Champions League football.
Right.
If there is change, though, do you think the Arsenal will make that investment to go and get a Diego Simeone? Because I don't see those players fitting into a Diego Simeone system, right? Am I wrong with that?
No, but any manager you bring in at this level, they're going to have to make a lot of turnover with players. There's going to be a different looking team. There's going to be a different style. The club will be the same. The badge will be the same. But I think at some point, it's been a couple decades, there's going to be a massive change whenever it comes.
Yeah, and I think I want to go back to something you said about selling London, and I think it ties into what you were talking about, Joe. Like, obviously, this is a great club with a huge history, and it's in a great city that a lot of people want to live in, and it has a tradition of success, you know, however moderate or relative the past 10 years. The thing is, like, yes, people are attracted to the club, but Arsene Wenger didn't go out and get them. And so I'm wondering if a guy who comes in is going to be more aggressive, like, for, you know, getting a guy like Simeone or Allegri there would require them to kind of make a big splash in the higher market in terms of a manager. And, you know, going back to your point, Sean, when you're saying, like, if someone needs to have the trophies to replace Arsene Wenger, I do think that and the adaptability of Allegri is important. But something that keeps jumping into my mind, I'll just throw it to you guys, it's not a deep point or anything, but if Eddie Howe is actually named the manager, can't you see kind of the same headlines that there were when Wenger took over? Can't you see The Guardian saying, Eddie who? On, you know, because it's going to be kind of the same thing. I mean, people know who he is, but
I hope there's a Guardian editor listening. You might have just got, you,
yeah, I might have just given you the headline if we're fortunate to be listening to us.
It would be the Sun, not the Guardian.
It would be the Sun,
run,
yeah. I do think that. It'd be hard to talk the fan base into that. It's a different climate than it was in 1996. It would be hard to talk a club like this into a hire like that. You need someone who has kind of the resume to do that and the trophy case to back it up. So I do think that's the move that the club should make.
I just want to say one thing. I'm sorry to bring up Chelsea again. It hurts me to do so. But, you know, there's a lot of talk about the business model with Arsenal. I just want to say Chelsea are top of the league, and they just made £60 million profit in the transfer window.
That's Chelsea Football Club. Hey, before we get out of here, let's give our Chelsea-Arsenal predictions. We'll start with Leander.
Chelsea 3, Arsenal 1.
Shahan?
2-1, Chelsea.
I'm going to go with a nightmare where I wake up again and get texts from friends. I'll say 5-0 Chelsea and like 4-0 after 30 minutes.
I'm going to say 4-2 Chelsea.
I told you guys, I think Arsenal's going to run roughshod on Chelsea. It's going to be 4-1 Arsenal.
anyone know a
what's
bookie?
In that drink over there, Jeff?
It's a little reverse psychology.
It's a good thing that your wife handles your finances.
On that note, we got to go. Thanks for listening. For Leander, Shahan, Joey, and Alex, I'm Joe Lago. You've been listening to the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast. Until next time, thanks for listening.